Did you itemize your deductions last year? If so, the IRS is encouraging you to do a checkup on your taxes to avoid any unpleasant year-end surprises. The Tax Cuts and Jobs Act is the biggest tax overhaul in many years, and significant changes to itemized deductions could affect your tax bill. We're getting the checkup started here on this edition of On Your Money. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Kevin McKinley is helping us look under the hood. He is a financial planner and managing member of McKinley Money LLC, and he joins us from WPR's friendly studio in Eau Claire. Hiya, Kevin.
Hello, Kate.
And if you have a personal finance question that you'd like Kevin to tackle, phone it in, 800-642-1234, or you can draft an email to onyourmoney@wpr.org. Tweet us at WPR Mornings. So, Kevin, let's start with the recent changes to the tax code that might require that we check our paychecks for the proper withholding amount.
That's right, Kate, and it's not just our paychecks. Any money we receive from somebody like pension checks or distributions from IRAs where someone else is withholding money, you should monitor this on a regular basis anyway, but especially in light of the recent changes to the tax rules from 2018, January 1st of 2018, the laws changed. And so now the itemized deductions have been reduced or eliminated in many cases, but rates have been lowered a little bit and the standard deduction has been increased. If you've had a change in your life between last year and this year, you might be withholding too much or not enough. And again, this is not just paychecks. This is pension checks, IRA checks, any kind of income distribution from which taxes are being withheld.
So how much should we be withholding?
Well, if you haven't had any big life changes in the past year, like a change in income or death or divorce or addition or subtraction of a child from your claiming, and if you're a Wisconsin resident or some of the other Midwestern states where the cost of living is relatively low, property taxes aren't going to be enough to offset some of the standard deduction amounts or the cap on deducting those amounts, you're probably okay. But you should pay at least 100% of last year's tax bill or at least 90% of what you think your estimated taxable income bill or tax bill will be, because if you don't meet those amounts, you're going to have penalties and you're going to have to start filing quarterly estimates. But at least if you pay in those dollar amounts, you could avoid the penalties.
And those penalties will kick in if we don't withhold enough, right?
Yeah, that's right. Not only are you going to have those penalties, but you're probably going to have to pay some money in on April 15th of next year of 2019. And that sometimes can create a scramble for people because they've spent the money that they should have been withholding for it. And again, they have to start filing those quarterly estimates, which are really a drag as well.
So what are the drawbacks of withholding too much?
Well, the good people at the state and federal revenue departments, they love it. They're not upset about that at all. But you lose the use of your money. You could use it to pay for those daily expenses or maybe pay down some high interest debt, save more for retirement, for college, and to cover emergencies that otherwise you're going to have to maybe put the money on a credit card or pull it out of one of those retirement accounts and have to pay some taxes and penalties on the withdrawal.
So how do you know the magic number? How do you know how much to withhold?
The IRS is so adamant about this, they've actually created a calculator you can use. If you sit down, plan for a few minutes on it, but go to irs.gov, and we'll have a link to the calculator at onyourmoney.com later on today. So you can go through there and just say, this is my situation. Am I withholding enough? And they also have a publication 505, which gives you more information about how to calculate the proper amount to withhold from all of your sources of taxable income. Now, a lot of people think that when they file a W-4 form that they have to send that to the IRS. No, if you need to change your withholding amount, usually for for the number of exemptions that you have, you've actually filed with your employer. And then if you're obviously getting money from your pension or Social Security or IRA distributions, you want to contact the people distributing that money and say, hey, I want to withhold more or I want to withhold less.
Kevin McKinley is the managing member of McKinley Money LLC, a registered investment advisor with offices in Eau Claire and Madison. Kevin McKinley does not intend to provide personalized investment advice through this broadcast and does not represent that the securities or services discussed are suitable for any investor. Investors should consult with their financial advisors prior to making any investment decisions. If you have a personal finance question you want to run by Kevin, you can phone it in at 800-642-1234. Send it in an email to onyourmoney@wpr.org or tweet us at WPR Mornings. Let's go to Mark, who is waiting in Grays Lake, Illinois. Hi, Mark.
Good morning, folks. How you doing?
Doing well. Go ahead.
Yeah, my question is this. A person is age 66, full retirement age. They'll be retiring in a few weeks. Can they wait until age 70 to draw the Social Security and, you know, in that interim period still get substantial increases in the amount they'll be eligible for?
Absolutely, Mark. Would this hypothetical person be you by any chance?
No, I've already retired, but it's a friend. She just turned 66, full retirement age.
Asking for a friend. That's always good.
Yeah, it's one of the least embarrassing asking for a friend questions we've had out here. Mark, yeah, that's nice of you to ask. And your friend can absolutely wait until age 70 as long as he has, you know, obviously other sources of income. Now, usually what happens is when you've reached full retirement age but you don't take Social Security, the Social Security check increases by 8% per year. So if he's expecting, say, $2,000 at age 66 and then he's going to wait a year, he can expect $2,160 for his first check following. Now, a lot of people fall under the impression that, well, then I'm getting an 8% return on my money, so it's a really good idea to wait. It can be a good idea to wait, but you're not getting 8% return on your money because you've missed out on 1 year's worth of checks. In the instance I just cited, this guy's given up $24,000 worth of checks to get $160 more, $160 more from his Social Security each month. And usually, as a rule of thumb, Mark, your friend has to live to be about 80 to make waiting make sense. There is still some increase that people do receive from waiting. It's not 8%. Most of the studies I've seen, usually it averages out to about 3 to 4%. So if you think you can do better than 3 to 4% per year on your own investments, you're probably better off taking Social Security now. If you say, no, there's no place I can find that kind of rate of return guaranteed, or I don't think I'm going to live till 80, or I just need the money, then your friend should probably take it.
And I think, Mark, you should name drop Kevin McKinley when you give your friend the answer. He'll be very impressed with
that. He heard it from a friend.
Yeah. Mark, thanks so much for the call. Well, we heard from a listener named Kyle who says, I'm a 25-year-old male. I graduated college last year and I'm currently making $73,000 gross. I'm putting 8% into 401k and my employer matches 10% along with a pension plan. He says he has no debt. He has established an emergency fund. And he wants to know what he can do now and in the future to maximize his savings, prepare himself for purchasing a house, and be ready for retirement. And he finishes with, thank you for the advice. You have a great show.
Well, thanks, Kyle. You just snuck in that false praise right at the last minute there. Yeah, you can start by saving even more for retirement. The limit for people under the age of 50 is the lesser of their income or $18,500 if they have a 401k, 403b, or 457 plan. And if you save that money, Kyle, into a pre-tax plan like a 401k, every dollar that you put into that saves you about 25 cents in taxes. So if you bump up your contributions, let's say you have an extra $10,000 that you could set aside, that'll cut your tax bill the following April 15th by about $2,500. And one of the reasons I love this question is because I realize that a lot of people, especially young adults just getting out of school, don't have a lot of extra money to save for college, but it allows me to illustrate the importance of saving something when you're young versus a lot when you're older. Let's say Kyle is able to max out his 401k contributions of $18,500 per year, and he only does it from 25 to 35. So that's $185,000 he'll save over those 10 years. If he stops, Kate, at age 35 and doesn't contribute anymore, if that money grows at a hypothetical return of 6% per year, by the time he's 65, he'll have about $1.4 million.
Wow.
And the rule of thumb about this is you can either save a dollar amount from 25 to 35 or 35 to 65, and you'll still end up with about the same amount of money. So if someone says, well, I'm not able to, I can't cut back, I say, that's fine, I'll start when I'm older. But because you've given up all that lost increase you might have had from 25 to 35, you have to save for 30 years at the dollar amount you would have had to save from 25 to 35 to, again, end up with just about the same amount.
Well, I'm going to be the money party crasher here. What about saving for buying a house?
Yeah, that's probably something that's on his radar here. And usually you want to aim for 20% of the purchase price as a down payment. There are other programs, especially for first-time home buyers, which will allow him to get in with a lower dollar amount. But his goal should be to try to have 20% down. And on a typical Midwestern home of $200,000 for a starter home, that means he's got to come up with $40,000. So he might be better off sliding that money towards the down payment fund, as you mentioned, rather than saving for retirement.
And how should he invest the money in these various accounts?
Well, he's really young, and so he has 40 years probably until he's going to be needing the money for retirement. So he can afford to be very aggressive with his 401k. He may want to diversify it amongst several different stock funds and then rebalance maybe on an annual basis and expect declines. And declines, Kyle, are going to be good if you have more money down the road to invest. Declines are only really bad when it goes down when you're trying to pull the money out. Now, for the emergency account and for saving for the home purchase, he can't afford to take a lot of risk with that. He's probably better off just putting it into a money market account, a CD or something like that. And in our Smart Assets segment later on today, we're going to talk about what I think would be a great investment for people who have some money to set aside for the short term. They don't want to take a lot of risk, but they would like a higher rate of return.
Let's go to Vicki waiting in Prentice. Hi, Vicki.
Good morning. I just wanted to quick throw out some balls, but actually real praise. Thank you both so much. You're really amazing, Kevin, and I appreciate your financial advice.
Thank you, Vicki.
I just wanted to ask about 529, the Edvest account. They have a special May 29th investment plan. And my question is, I read their terms and conditions, and it says the money is neither insured nor guaranteed. So that actually spooked me a little bit.
Right. It is 529 today if you're listening to this live on a Tuesday. And if you're listening at the rebroadcast on Saturday at noon, it's not 529. But a lot of times these college plans are known as 529 plans because that's the section of the tax code that allows them to exist. And so as a way to generate a little bit of publicity, they come out with special promotions or information or ad campaigns around 529, May 29th. And the Edvest program of which you speak, Vicki, that actually does have a couple different portfolios. I think the disclaimer that you saw in there was kind of a broad-based one, and it didn't cover every single investment in there, but they do have a couple of what are known as stable principal investment options, one of which is a bank CD portfolio that invests at least, as I remember, about 80% of his assets in CDs with shorter-term maturities like 24 months. And the other is a principal plus interest account, which is kind of like a stable value account or a fixed rate annuity account. And both of those are much safer than the other stock funds offered in the Edvest or any other 529 plan. But they're not going to pay very much either. And the problem with those, of course, is that if you're saving money for college, you want something that's hopefully going to grow over the long term to exceed or at least equal the increase in college cost. And those two very safe portfolios will not likely cover that cost. But where people would want to look at it is if they say, I just want to have the money there and I'm going to need it in a year or two. I'm saving for a 17-year-old, or I've accumulated a balance and this 17-year-old's going to go off to college in a year. We don't want to take any risks with that money for a sudden loss. So therefore, we're going to slide it into these more conservative ones. And I'm as paranoid as they come, Vicki, about these kinds of things. I'm still very confident, especially relative to other 529 savings options, that the bank CD portfolio in the Edvest account is about as safe as you can get and still save in a 529.
Vicki, thanks for the call. You are with us for On Your Money. Kevin McKinley is a financial planner and managing member of McKinley Money LLC. Your personal money questions in the mix, as always, at 800-642-1234. Send them by email to onyourmoney@wpr.org. Coming up, Series I savings bonds are low risk, but are they worth the 30-year wait? Stay with us for more On Your Money here on the Ideas Network. Cooking up another edition of On Your Money here on the Ideas Network. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Kevin McKinley is in our midst. He's a financial planner and managing member of McKinley Money LLC. Your personal finance questions along the way at 800-642-1234. You can email them to onyourmoney@wpr.org. Tweet us at WPR Mornings. Let's go to Lee joining us from Cudahy. Hi, Lee.
Good morning. Thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
I know that CDs are insured for $250,000 by the FDIC. However, recently we renewed a CD, and I made the passing remark to the lady that next time we'll probably have to take money out because it'll be over $250,000. And she looked at the CD and says, well, you, your wife, and a beneficiary are all insured for $250,000. Therefore, you could have a CD worth $750,000. Is that correct?
Well, technically, the insurance depends on the titling of the accounts, and the way that can work, for example, is that a person like we, you could have one account there at the bank for $250,000 that would be FDIC insured, and then you and your spouse could have a joint account that owns a CD, and that would also have another $250,000 of insurance. And then there are some ways you can drill down in the way of having multiple beneficiaries of the different CDs that would allow you to also exceed the $250,000 at one particular institution. The FDIC has a calculator they call ED in their efforts to humor people and familiarize them with the FDIC. They call it EDIE, and that's their electronic deposit insurance estimator. So if you go online at FDIC.gov and then look for EDIE, you can then calculate if your money is insured. As long as it's under $250,000, it's fine. But if you have multiple accounts at different banks or at the same bank, and then it'll start asking you, well, how are they titled? And then based on your responses to it, that can tell you if you can do it. But yes, it is possible to exceed $250,000 at one institution as long as you have different titlings and beneficiaries. And we'll put a link, Lee, up to that website at our website, onyourmoney.com. Again, later on today.
We have an email here. Paula in Cedarburg reached out and says, I follow you every week. I'm 70, recently completed my BA at Concordia University, Wisconsin, and received tuition reimbursement for 70% of the cost. I have a student loan for $9,000 at 3.6% interest. Given I probably won't file long form for IRS next year, should I simply pay off the entire loan? Is there any advantage now to leaving the loan and the small interest rate?
That's a pretty low interest rate, and congratulations, Paul. And I hope that she means by follows me every week, she actually just listens to the show and isn't stalking me or anything like that. I don't mind stalkers, but I just would like you to keep your safe distance if you could, please. Yeah, Paul, good for you, and congratulations on earning your degree. I wouldn't be in any big hurry to pay that off, especially if you don't have a lot of other resources from which to draw in an emergency. If you know you're going to be having, let's say you have an IRA and you're over 70 and a half and you're going to be pulling out the required minimum distribution and that money will be there to use, then I'd say, yeah, go ahead and pay that off. But otherwise, no, that's a pretty low interest rate. And if it's a fixed interest rate and other interest rates rise over the next term, well, you might find yourself going to banks and getting 3.5 or 4% or more interest on a certificate of deposit, and then you can make money on the spread between what it's costing you for the loan and what you're achieving on the proceeds you would have otherwise used to pay the loan off.
So, Kevin, several listeners heard you mention Series I savings bonds a few weeks ago and would like more information. What can you tell us?
Yeah, I can tell you that these are my most favorite boring investment out there.
Now, tell us what you really feel.
That's right. Now, these are fantastic. See, these savings bonds are direct from the United States government, which is the safest source of funds in the world, and it's known as a direct obligation, meaning that the U.S. government has to tax its citizens enough to pay off these bonds no matter what happens. And the interest rate right now on the Series I savings bonds is 2.52%. And the way the interest rate works on Series I savings bonds is there are two components. A fixed rate that stays with the bonds as long as you own them, that's 0.3%. And then every May and November, a new variable rate is set for those particular bonds, and it usually depends on what the inflation rate is. But so right now it's 0.3% guaranteed, and then you get another 2.22% for a total interest rate of 2.52%. And that rate, Kate, is even better than it appears.
How so?
Because there are no state income taxes on the interest. So getting 2.52% on a savings bond is kind of like getting about 2.75 or 2.8% on a certificate of deposit that would otherwise be taxable at the state and federal level. And when you purchase these Series I savings bonds, you get to choose whether or not you're going to declare the interest and pay taxes on it every single year, or if you're going to defer the taxation until you cash the bonds in or they mature. So a lot of people say, I want to park some money aside while I'm working. I've maxed out my 401k or IRA options, but I'd like to tax defer some other money. They can put it into Series I savings bonds, avoid taxation while they're building up the interest, and then afterwards when the people retire, they can cash the bonds in, pay the taxes on the interest, and at that time they're probably going to be at least in the same tax bracket, but probably in a lower bracket at all. And then Vicki, one of our faithful listeners, had a question before about trying to save safely for college. These Series I savings bonds also have a special way that you can save money for college safely.
And what is that?
If the bonds are owned in just the parent's name, so it's if young parents trying to figure out where to save money for college, and they want to keep it very safe, they can buy Series I savings bonds or double E bonds, but I bonds are a better deal. They can buy Series I bonds, and then once the child is ready to go to college, if the parents cash in the bonds and use the proceeds to pay for qualified higher education expenses, the proceeds are tax-free. So all of the interest that you've earned, you don't pay any taxes on it whatsoever. Now, you do have to be below an income limit when the bonds are cashed in, but that income limit is pretty liberal in terms of what you can get away with. It's $93,000 right now for single filers and $147,000 for married couples filing jointly. So as long as your income is below that limit that's established when you cash them in, the proceeds will be tax-free, again, if you use it for qualified higher education expenses.
Are there any downsides to these bonds?
You cannot use Series I savings bonds in IRAs or Roth IRAs. Mm-hmm. As you mentioned, Kate, they are 30-year bonds. However, it's tough to get your money out early within the first 12 months of when you take it out. But after that point, there's only a three-month penalty for early withdrawal. So if you keep it in there a year and a half, you're only going to pay 3 months of interest if you pull it out early. And after you've owned the bonds for 5 years, there's no penalty to pull the money out whatsoever. There's also a limit on how much of these bonds you can buy. The government sets the limit at $10,000 per person per calendar year. You might be able to get a little bit more if you are getting a tax refund from the federal government and you can have that money directed into purchasing a bond for it. And then finally, you can only buy these bonds online. So you have to go to treasurydirect.gov, treasurydirect.gov to get more information. And it's kind of a tricky process to start, but once you get familiar with it and you open an account, it's a little easier to make subsequent future purchases. And again, we'll have that website, treasurydirect.gov, at our website, onyourmoney.com. Later on today.
But the paper bonds were so regal looking and beautiful.
Would you get them for your birthday from your grandma?
Yeah, and I can't believe we moved away from paper.
I know. Well, and then what's kind of sad about this is, and I think it's actually by design, I think that that there are hurdles put into place because these are such good investments. The government doesn't want people to take advantage. They want to have it out there, but they don't want too many people taking advantage of it. So they put artificial limits on how much you can buy. And then obviously they've made it more difficult, like you said, to get the actual paper bonds. Everything's online.
Kevin McKinley is our trusted guide. He's a financial planner, managing member of McKinley Money LLC. If you have a personal finance question, keep it up. Call it in, 800-642-1234. Email that question to onyourmoney@wpr.org. Tweet us at WPR Mornings. Let's go to John waiting in Reed. Hi, John.
Hello.
Hi, go ahead.
Yeah, I got a question for the gentleman. My significant other, she passed, and she's got a 401k, and I've got mine. Is there any advantage to rolling, or can I roll them together? I'm getting ready to retire. I'm getting ready to turn 66, so I don't know. What can I do?
Yeah, John, well, first of all, our condolences for your loss. And I'm sorry, were you married to this other person?
Yes.
Okay. And were you named as the beneficiary of the 401k?
Yes.
Okay. You can roll this over into your own IRA, and it makes it easier to manage for it as well. Have you contacted the custodian yet of the 401k to see what the process of that is?
I have not. I don't know what to do. So
okay. You probably have some statement that came in her name to your address, correct?
Correct.
Okay. On there, John, there'll be a toll-free number that you can call to ask them what the procedure is. Explain the situation. You won't be the first person probably to call even today with this request. Or if you do decide you're going to set up your own IRA so that you can just manage everything yourself and keep it all together, and wherever you're going to have the IRA, whether it's a credit union, a bank, or a financial services company, those people should know how to transfer that over. And quite frankly, they should do the work for you if you're going to pay them some fees or commissions to invest the money for you. They should be willing to do the work and handle all the paperwork for you. So if you do have someone in mind for it, have them do it rather than you having to navigate all of this this paperwork and everything yourself.
Well, John, best of luck, and thanks so much for calling in. So since we're on the topic of rolling over, Kevin, we have Yakov, who wrote an email saying, I'm 22, recently switched jobs. At my previous job, I had a 403B. Current job, they don't offer a 401K. I'm going to roll over my funds into a retirement fund. What type of IRA do you suggest? IRA or Roth IRA? What type of investments do you suggest?
Well, depending on your age and your situation, you may want to hold off on rolling that over, because when you move money into an IRA, the good news is it's tax-free. There's no taxes when you move the money into the IRA. It's only when you actually pull it out to spend it that you might incur some taxation. If you keep it, though, in a 401k or 403b, or to a lesser extent, some people have 457 plans, it's easier to get access to that money at age 55 without a penalty. An IRA, if you usually pull it out and spend it before you turn 59 and a half, you not only pay taxes on the withdrawal, but you also pay a 10% penalty if it's not for a qualified reason. And the 401k, if you've separated from service for the company, can be easier to get at as well. So if it's a significant amount of money and you think there's a chance you'll need it before 59 and a half, you may want to just leave it where it's at and kind of manage it there. Otherwise, if you're moving it into an IRA, it's difficult to give you investment advice over the air because we don't know your specific situation. But if you think your tax bracket is going to be lower now, Yakov, than it is going to be in retirement, it might be a good idea to convert that fund from 401k or 403b to a Roth IRA and pay taxes on it. You don't pay any 10% penalty on it, even if you're under 59 and a half, because you're converting it. You're not spending the money out for it. But a lot of times people who lose their jobs, you know, they go without income for several weeks or months, and then they're kind of artificially in a lower tax bracket that year. So it could make very good sense to convert it from a regular tax-deferred account into the Roth. And then once you convert it, there's no taxes on it when you pull it out in retirement, and there is no mandatory distribution at age 70 and a half like you would have if you keep it in the pre-tax plan.
So don't get too rollover ambitious at a young age.
Right.
Is that the takeaway there? Can you see if we can go back to the phones here? Jane in North... Terry, I'm sorry, in North Lake. Terry, hi, go ahead.
Good morning. I have a question. Some years ago, My granddaughter was quite young. My husband at the time and I and family was giving our granddaughter savings bonds, and then a divorce occurred, and they don't have a remembrance of the bonds, and there was moving and all that sort of thing, so they, you know, are gone, potentially, the paper product of it. Is there a way to retrieve those savings bonds?
Yeah, absolutely. Go to treasurydirect.gov, and again, you will not be the first person today to visit that website trying to find lost savings bonds. And as much information as you can put in there is helpful, like social security numbers, et cetera. If you happen to have, you know, the bond security number, account number, that would help as well. But no, people with less ability than you, Terry, have already made this same mistake or had the circumstances that happened to them in life. And so the Treasury does acknowledge that. And so I would go to treasurydirect.gov, and then they have a section page on there if you have a lost savings bond, what to do, how to claim the one and get it back into the account in the good name of the person who is rightfully able to collect the interest and then redeem it if they wish.
Good luck, Terry, on retrieving that. Let's go to Jane now in North Prairie. Jane, go ahead.
Good morning. You have the best financial show in the universe. There's your false praise. Anyway, I was wondering, can you buy an iBond with a Discover card or another credit card that gives you cash back and squeeze out another point or two of interest?
Yeah, that's actually a great question, Jane. And there really was a provision from the Treasury that used to allow you to buy savings bonds with a credit card. But they've terminated that. I think it was probably about 10 or 15 years ago. However, what you can do is if you get cash back on a card, you can have the savings go into your checking account, and then you can use the savings from the checking account to purchase a bond. And the minimum is only about $25, so it shouldn't take too much into savings to actually purchase the bond. So eventually you can get there, and that's a good idea to do that. You know, you're kind of just bending over, picking up nickels to get this extra rate of return. But you can't do it directly just by saying, hey, if I get cash back on my credit card, I want it to go towards a savings bond.
Well, Jane, good thinking there. You can find valuable insights to life's common money questions. You're with us for On Your Money. Kevin McKinley is our trusted guide. He is a financial planner and managing member of McKinley Money, LLC. Do you have a money question that's been keeping you up at night? Call it in at 800-642-1234. You can write it down in an email and address it to onyourmoney@wpr.org. Coming up, with the summer sun beating down on us, it's high time we get our money's worth out of sunscreen. Got you covered there. Stay with us. We'll be back in just a moment here on the Ideas Network. Life happens, and so do the money questions that follow. That's where Kevin McKinley can help. He is a financial planner and managing member of McKinley Money, LLC. You are with us for another edition of On Your Money. I'm Kate Archer-Kent, gathering up all your fabulous money questions and lessons at 800-642-1234. You can ask your personal finance question for Kevin McKinley. You can send that money situation by email to onyourmoney@wpr.org. You can also tweet us at WPR Mornings. So, Kevin, the summer outdoor season is finally here, but there are a few things that we should know and do before we head out to enjoy the sun.
Yes, that is try to avoid skin cancer. More Americans are diagnosed with skin cancer than all other cancers combined every single year. As a country, we spend about $8.1 billion covering precancer and skin cancer and melanoma ailments, and it was one of the most preventable forms of cancer. And the safest thing, of course, is to get in the shade, wear one of those sun shirts, or even any kind of shirt or whatever. And usually the sun shirts, sometimes, you know, they have a tighter weave to them, but any other kind of shirt can help. And then also, obviously, put sunscreen on. And a lot of people are doing it the wrong way, and they're doing it in a way that's not cost-effective. So we have some of the ways that you can make sure you cover up most effectively for both being safe, but also being smart about the cost.
So where should we begin?
Do not use sprays. Creams and lotions are much more effective and much more cost-effective. In fact, Consumer Reports advises against using sprays, especially spraying them on younger children or in the face. The fumes may be dangerous to inhale, and it can be a fire hazard as well. And the American Academy of Dermatology also says do not spray sunscreen on the face, just because they're not sure yet that the chemicals in those sprays are safe to be that close to the face. When you are using your cream or lotion sunscreen, you want to use at least 1 ounce to cover your entire body. That's about a shot class, and what the AAD has found, that people only use about half that much. And so now if you do carry a shot glass around with you to the beach, you have an excuse for it. You say, well, I want to make sure I use the proper amount of sunscreen. SPF 30 is probably the minimum of the blockage factor you want to use. And keep in mind, those sunscreens cannot use the word waterproof anymore. They have to use the phrase water resistant, and that means that once you jump into the lake and swim around for a while, once you get back out, if you're going to be in the sun, you should reapply that screen because it's probably been washed off while you've been in the water.
Are there any particular brands that are more effective than others?
Consumer Reports just released their exhaustive study on how effective they were, and the highest rated one was something called La Roche-Posay, which can be purchased for the mere price of $7.20 per ounce.
Wow.
But that was a 100 rating from Consumer Reports. If you want the 99 rating, get the Equate One, the sport version lotion with an SPF 50 from Walmart. And that is less than one-tenth of the cost, only 63 cents per ounce.
And you mentioned the environmental dangers of sunscreen.
Right. Some substances can be dangerous to you and to the environment, according to whom you speak. In terms of the environment, there's a chemical called oxybenzone that can be dangerous, especially to coral reefs. So if you're near the ocean, don't use oxybenzone. As a matter of fact, several interest groups are trying to get that chemical banned because they think it's causing bleaching and deterioration and erosion to the coral reefs. And in terms of you, the Environmental Working Group releases a study every single year, and they say that oxybenzone and octinoxate can be dangerous to human beings. The American Academy of Dermatology disagrees and says, no, you're much more likely to be endangered by not using sunscreen than you are by any of the ingredients in any of the sunscreens that are approved by the FDA for use in human beings.
Are there any other tips for avoiding the harmful effects of the sun?
Yes, don't be placated by the fact that it's a cloudy day. On cloudy days, 80% of the rays can still penetrate the clouds and get to you and damage your skin. And clothing is, again, the sunscreen clothing does work to some degree. It's difficult to tell exactly how much because it has a lot to do with the fibers and how closely knit they are, but it could be a good investment, especially if you have kids who are going to be on the beach for a long time. You want to get those long sleeve swimming shirts on them as well. Don't forget about your lips, because a lot of people aren't going to put sunscreen on their lips, but lips have a very high incidence of skin cancer and melanoma. And as a good rule of thumb, just keep babies out of the sun, because you shouldn't put sunscreen on anybody younger than 6 months of age. Therefore, you shouldn't have anybody younger than 6 months of age exposed to the sun.
Well, let's go back to the phones now with Eugene waiting in Lac des Flambeaux. Hi, Eugene.
Hello.
What's going on with your money situation?
Oh, I just have a couple of questions I was going to ask Kevin. If I bought some stock 20 years ago, and then every year I paid my dividends, taxes, file them, if I want to take some money out and I take it out, do I have to pay taxes on the dividends that I already had?
Yeah, Eugene, if I get this straight, this is not in an IRA or anything, right?
No, right.
Okay, and so you've been reinvesting these dividends, but you've still been paying taxes on them, right?
Right.
Okay, I'm glad you brought this up because some people have the misperception that if they buy shares in a stock or a mutual fund and have the dividends reinvested, if it's outside of their IRA, as long as they just don't take the money, they don't have to pay taxes. And the fact is, every year that they've received a dividend, even if it's been reinvested, it still is potentially taxable income. And I'm guessing, Eugene, over the years, the good news is because you've increased your cost basis, it's a lot higher than what you established when you first bought the stock, that it probably the taxable bill for pulling any money out will be lower than what you think. And maybe even non-existent, depending on what the price of the stock has done. However, you now have to calculate your stock, your cost basis, and there's a couple different methods you can to use that of identification, et cetera, that you can use to calculate the cost basis, but you do have to calculate the cost basis. It probably won't be taxable. If it is taxable, it probably won't be very much, but you do have to still report to the IRS what the cost basis is of the shares that you are taking out from the dividend reinvestment plan.
Well, Eugene, thanks so much for calling in with that question. Let's now go to Don, who is waiting in Milwaukee. Don, hi.
Yes, hello. Thank you for taking my call. Can you hear me?
Yes, yes.
Okay, so I got a second job to pay off personal debt. Now, the second job also offers a retirement plan. My first job offers 401k, the second one 403b. They both are managed by Transamerica. First question is, should I pay off debt before I do the retirement planning on the second job?
Yeah.
And the second question is, can I max out my retirement of 16 and a half a year from each job, or does that 16 and a half have to be divided by both jobs?
Yeah, Don, good for you, first of all, for taking on a second job. We've actually talked about this, I think, last week. It's good to hear you bring this up on the air because there are a lot of people out there who are struggling with money problems, and they feel like they're doing all they can, but they might not be. They haven't looked at taking other jobs to help supplement their income so that they can pay down debt or save for retirement or cover expenses or whatever. And I know there's a lot of people out there who have got, like you said, Kate, their side hustle.
Mm-hmm.
But some people have to realize that there are actually a lot of people. When you see someone, you know, who takes your change for coffee or whatever at Starbucks or something, that person may be teaching or may have some other kind of job where they're earning extra money, but they're trying to pick up some cash here at this particular job. So really good for you to do it. Don, do you know what the interest rate is on that debt?
It's in the 20s.
Okay.
Credit cards.
Definitely. Okay, that's good to hear, and you should definitely pay that off sooner. You'll get a way bigger bang for your buck by paying that debt off than you will by saving it in a pre-tax plan for retirement, because it's a good idea to save money in a pre-tax plan for retirement, but you just get the tax break once. Like we were alluded to with the earlier question from Kyle, you get that tax break on that deposit, and then you get hopefully no taxation on the earnings while you leave it in there, but then you still have to pay taxes on it when you pull it out. But those credit cards, and those are going to charge you 20% every single year, and as long as the balance is outstanding, it can affect your credit rating, which can then cause you to pay more for auto insurance or homeowners insurance premiums or any other place that you might be borrowing money. So I would channel all the money that you have into paying off the credit cards first. Maybe the only thing I would do before that is set up like an emergency fund of 3 months worth of living expenses before you then hit the credit card company, because I'm guessing you got into the credit card debt because you probably ran into some trouble and you needed to use those to cover living expenses.
Yes, correct.
Oh, yeah. And that's common. And, you know, I'd rather have you do that than starve. But now that you're back on your feet again, no, please use that money to first establish a 3 months of living expense emergency fund, and then use whatever you can to pay off the credit cards as quickly as you possibly can. And then and only then would I advise you to save money for retirement. And once you get there, it depends on the types of accounts that each employer offers, if you can do that. But that'll be a good problem to have at that point. And I'm guessing it'll be a while before you reach that point.
It's interesting, too, that both of the firms that Don works for offers retirement benefits to employees. I mean, unless Don has superhero powers and is able to have more hours in the day. One of those jobs is part-time, so offering retirement for part-time employees, that's a plus, right, Kevin?
Yeah, good for them. I like that. You know, anyone can open up a retirement account, an IRA, even if you don't have an employer-offered plan. But employer-offered plans usually offer much higher contribution limits than just an IRA. An IRA, you can maybe do $5,500 or your income, whichever is less. You might be able to get $6,500 if you're over 50. You might be able to open up a spousal IRA or Roth IRA, but it's much easier to save much more money into employer-sponsored plans than it is an IRA or Roth IRA.
Let's go to Ernest in Madison. Ernest, hi.
Hello.
Hi, Ernest. Are you there?
Hi.
Yeah.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. Go ahead.
The question I have is I help my grandkids out in college, and I've been giving them cash for their tuition. And I've been taking some of my stocks and cashing my stocks and then giving them the cash. But however, my stocks have a very high gain, and I've got this capital gains that I'm paying. Could I just give the kids directly the stock instead of giving them cash? And if I did, what's involved in doing something like that?
Right, Ernest. Well, first of all, you're a very benevolent family member to be able to help these kids out at all. So good for you. That's a really, that's a great benefit to do that. And I'm not even sure most college kids don't appreciate how awesome this is until they get older and go, oh my gosh, I can't believe he did that. That's right. That really made a big difference. So thank you to you for doing that. And the second thing is when you give stock to someone else, the bad news is that your cost basis goes with that stock. So if you paid $1 a share for it and it's worth $10 now, even if you give the shares to the kids, they still have a capital gain of $9 per share when they go ahead and sell it. But the good news is they're probably going to be in a lower tax bracket than you are. And so they may be able to avoid capital gains completely by selling it and being in that low tax bracket. So that might save some money for it there. The only thing I would watch out for is if they are filing for need-based financial aid and they have an asset in stock or they sell the stock, it will reduce how much need-based aid that they get, and even more so than if you were just to give them a check for the proceeds for it, too. So if they're not applying for need-based financial aid, then yes, they should probably sell it because they will probably be in a lower capital gains bracket. The only way you can avoid the capital gains by giving the stock to somebody is leaving to them at death, in which case they would get a new what's called a stepped-up cost basis. That's the cost basis that's usually on the day that you pass away.
Well, Ernest, thanks for the call. Kevin, it's that time. What is the website of the week?
Yeah, before we get to that, Kate, quickly, people wanted to know what that really low-cost sunscreen was. They've been flooding the phone lines with it. It's Walmart's Equate Sport Lotion SPF 50. It's a Best Buy from Consumer Reports. They gave it an overall score of 99 out of 100, and it's only 63 cents per ounce, much cheaper than any other sunscreen in their database.
Yes.
That's right. The website of the week is it's called kccsecure.com. And what happened is they launched a class action suit because Dish Network called people on the do not call list, and they won tons of money, millions and millions of dollars, so much so that they're giving out $1,200 if you qualified for it. But they can't even find enough people who qualified for this, and so they created a website. It's legitimate. You can enter your phone number in there, and they will tell you if you qualify for this $1,200 portion of the class action settlement. KCCsecure.com, and we'll have a link to that website at our website onyourmoney.com later on today.
And four more words before we go.
Spend less, have more.
Kevin McKinley is a financial planner and managing member of McKinley Money LLC. And On Your Money can be heard on the Ideas Network Tuesday mornings at 8. It is rebroadcast Saturdays at noon. This edition of On Your Money was produced by Keely Baltina and Sarah Hopeful. Michael Derringer provided technical direction. I'm Kate Archer-Kent, and On Your Money comes to you on the Ideas Network.